Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with author, journalist and renewable energy advocate Harvey Wasserman. Harvey's been involved with the anti-nuclear movement for over 30 years and is featured regularly across major media in the US. He's also the senior editor of The Free Press. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe and other major newspapers and magazines, including Rolling Stone and The Nation. In 1973, Harvey Wasserman helped to pioneer the global grassroots movement against atomic reactors, and he coined the phrase, no nukes, in 1974. Rolling Stone featured Harvey Wasserman on its 1979 cover story on the Musicians United for Safe Energy, otherwise known as MUSE, which staged five concerts organized by Harvey in Madison Square Garden shortly after the Three Mile Island accident, including New York City's 1979 No Nukes concert featuring Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, James Taylor and others. Harvey is an author and co-author of a dozen books, including Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States. He's lectured at colleges and universities since 82 on the issues of energy, environment, politics and history. Harvey joins me now from Ohio, and welcome to the program, Harvey.
It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Great. Let's go back to Seabrook, Harvey, when we first came in contact with each other in 1975. Were you the one that dismantled that big tower at the Seabrook site?
Well, actually, there was a guy who climbed the tower at Seabrook. His name was Ron Reek. He did it in the middle of January. He climbed up this 100-foot tower with three sheets of plywood and camped there, shocking everybody. But the tower that went down was in Montague, Massachusetts, on February 22nd of 1974, and that was done by a fellow who lived on my communal farm named Sam Lovejoy, and he did a beautiful protest and was tried and acquitted, actually, for the civil disobedience of knocking over that tower. My claim to fame at the time was to coin the phrase no nukes, N-O-N-U-K-E-S, which kind of happened through my typewriter. So that's the fun I had.
Well, were you at that first demonstration at Seabrook where I spoke through a megaphone standing on the rubbish dump where they eventually built the Seabrook reactor? Were you there?
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. And, you know, we had the first mass civil disobedience arrests at Seabrook in New Hampshire on the Atlantic coast, just above the Massachusetts border, beginning on August 1st of 1976, and then again August 22nd of 76, and then April 30th of 77, when we had 2,000 people come on to the nuclear site, and about 1,400 were arrested. And that was really the protest that put nuclear power into the global media, because the governor of New Hampshire insisted on locking people up in National Guard armories, and it became kind of a worldwide cause célèbre. Yeah, we sort of got onto this crustacean theme where we had the Clamshell Alliance in Seabrook. We had the Abalone Alliance at Diablo Canyon in California, where I believe you also spoke, and I was arrested there in 1984. And we had the Crabshell Alliance up in the Northwest, and many other alliances all around the United States that really helped stop the massive push to build hundreds of nuclear plants in the U.S. You know, Richard Nixon in 74 said there will be 1,000 commercial reactors in the United States by the year 2000, and now it's 2008 and there are just 104, which is still 104 too many, but nowhere near as bad as it might have been had we not gone out and demonstrated.
Yeah, that's right. Now let's get on to the present election. And people need to know that we're taping this. What date is it there for you now? I'm taping from Canberra, Australia, but we're a day ahead of you. So what date is it there, Harvey?
It's June 4th, yep. And Hillary Clinton has essentially acknowledged that Barack Obama has enough votes to become the Democratic nominee.
Oh, she has.
Things are going to get very interesting. But, you know, as far as nuclear power goes, Barack Obama has said he's generally in favor of nuclear power, but he has also said that he will not let the Yucca Mountain nuclear dump open, which he pretty much has to do if he's going to carry the state of Nevada in this upcoming election. So we will see about that.
He's from Illinois, where there are, I think, 11 operating nuclear power plants, many of them surrounding Chicago. Exelon runs those reactors, many of them. And he's taken, what, about $240,000 from Exelon for his campaign, Harvey?
Yes, he has, which is unfortunate, and we're hoping to dissuade him. I mean, you know, we're getting to the point now where the wind and solar industries are going to be big enough to be able to make similar contributions to candidates. I think that's going to be our saving grace, because the renewable energy industry is becoming so profitable and so powerful that soon we may be able to match dollar for dollar with the failing nuclear industry in terms of campaign donations.
Yeah, but how do we get into Obama's little pink ear? How do we get to him and have half an hour of his time, Harvey, to explain the medical consequences of nuclear power and radioactive waste?
Well, one good sign is that he has, you know, rock musicians have a fair amount of power in this country because they're so popular and they are able to raise money in concerts. And so Jackson Browne and Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash, other musicians who have been mainstays of the anti-nuclear movement do have some access to him. And, you know, I actually met Hillary Clinton with Bonnie Raitt. And so I think at some point we will have some more, hopefully, conversations with him. I think he's very sincere in his advocacy for renewable energy. It's just he has to, and he's also said, by the way, which is interesting, that he does not support subsidies for nuclear power plants. Now, as far as I'm concerned, he can be in favor of nuclear power plants all he wants, as long as he is president, stops them from getting the subsidies, because they can't build any reactors without subsidies.
Yeah, it's a socialized industry.
After 50 years, this industry is a financial failure. And, you know, without massive welfare bailouts, they're not going to build any more reactors.
Let's go on to Senator McCain.
Well, let's not.
Oh, yeah. I want you to talk about his policy towards, or attitude towards, nuclear power, Harvey.
Well, he's totally pro-nuclear. He supports, John McCain supports massive subsidies for the nuclear industry. He wants all the federal money. You know, I love how these guys are big fans of Adam Smith and the free market, but then when it comes to building nuclear plants, they're more than happy to pour billions of dollars of our taxpayer money into subsidizing a technology that can't make it in the marketplace. And so John McCain is a big supporter of subsidies for nuclear power plants, and this is a serious problem. He also supports Yucca Mountain and pretty much anything that the nuclear industry wants, he's poised to give them. So I think we're going to have to be pretty strong in our opposition to Mr. McCain in this upcoming election.
So why do you think he has these attitudes? Is he not very bright, or has he been bought and sold, or is he like Faust?
Both of the above, I think. I don't think he's all that smart, frankly. And I think that he has been bought and paid for by the nuclear power industry. And, you know, we're just going to have to go on that assumption. I mean, he talks, you know, just, all the same stuff about renewables and how, in fact, his campaign ad, while he's in the middle of supporting massive subsidies for nuclear power, his campaign ad shows a windmill, you know, which is ridiculous. It's just completely hypocritical. But that's what we're living with now in this country, is they're all genuflecting towards renewable energy, but some are doing for it and some aren't. I mean, we do have some genuine renewable energy advocates in the government now. And as the industry booms ahead, I think we'll start to see some financial clout as well.
He may as well just put a windmill on top of a nuclear power plant for his ad, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, as long as the power plant is shut, I mean, I think you and I have probably both visited Rancho Seco in California. Here we have a nuclear plant that was shut in 1989. It's the only nuclear reactor I've ever been inside. I went in because it's shut. And but it's surrounded by photovoltaic cells.
Is it really?
The photovoltaic cells are still operating, and the nuclear plant isn't. And
no, but where's its waste? Where are they storing its radioactive waste?
Well, right on site, I'm afraid, in the dry cask. You know, the high-level nuclear waste hasn't moved in this country. It's still sitting in dry casks and in spent fuel pools at all the reactor sites. There are about 70 different reactor sites in this country. And there's no prospect for that stuff moving. In fact, now there's serious talk about making the dry casks a lot more substantial so they can withstand terrorist attack and so on.
Yeah. Harvey, you wrote a book called Solartopia a couple of years ago, obviously totally topical for today. Can you just explain to the audience the major points in that book, please?
Well, Solartopia is a visioning of what the world will look like after we switch to renewable energy and shut down all the coal and oil and nukes and gas facilities. Coal, oil, nukes, and gas, I term King Kong, which is our battle basically to save the planet from this 800-pound gorilla. And it posits a world, it portrays a world in which we are absolutely free of fossil and nuclear fuels. And the premise is that we start on a biofueled airliner, takes off from Hamburg, where we had the first hydrogen gas station or hydrogen fueling station, and we fly over Copenhagen and Northern Europe, and then across the Atlantic and across the United States to Hawaii, and all the time we're looking down at a world that has switched to wind power, to photovoltaic cells, to solar architecture, has revived mass transit, is using biofuels, wave energy, tidal energy, geothermal energy, and, of course, tremendously increased efficiency. And the point is to portray, to give us a visual, holistic image of the world as it should and can and will operate, which is completely on renewables and efficiency, a green-powered Earth, which is prosperous, where there is full employment, and where we don't have to worry about terrorist attacks on nuclear plants and all those kinds of things. Now, I'm actually going to redo the book. It's basically our green-powered Earth 2030, but I'm going to take the date off and do some updating. The one of the dangers of writing about renewable energy is that there are so many advances being made and so much success with the technology that you really have to race to keep up.
Mm. Well, tell us what the latest advances are in terms of investment, in terms of people getting into it, in terms of what are the new technologies that are being developed. Harvey, tell us what's happening.
Well, as we speak, there are $6 billion worth of wind farms under construction in the United States.
Oh, my God.
And these plants are all coming in under budget and ahead of schedule. Very, very profitable. Huge amounts of money are being made in the wind power business. We have just had a situation where Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, has pulled his financing of a proposed nuclear plant in Idaho, but at the same time is expanding his investments in wind power. Mm. He owns a $250 million wind farm in Iowa, and the advances in, well, the major, you know, it's kind of wonky, but the major advances in wind power now seem to be a major shift away from windmills with gears and towards gearless windmills, which may be way more efficient. There's also a major movement for community ownership, and this is a big piece of the puzzle. Nearly all the major wind farms in the United States have been developed by large corporations, and we are working so that farmers and individual landowners and communities and municipal utilities can own these wind farms, and so that the profits will go back into the community rather than off into corporate coffers. You know, a wind farm can be a big boon to a corporation, but it can also be a big boon to a community if the community owns it, and that's what we're really looking for. In terms of solar, there are just a constant flow of advances. Recently, I wrote a major article for a magazine called Renewable Energy World, where I visited a factory in Michigan, just outside Detroit, where they are manufacturing solar shingles. Now, these are roofing shingles that incorporate amorphous silicon technology, and so you put these shingles on your roof, and then on the backside, you plug into the roof, and you have a perfectly ordinary-looking roof, except that it generates the electricity for the house. I mean,
wow.
These things are visually indistinguishable from a normal unsolar rooftop, and yet they are very efficient and very durable, actually, very hard to
harm. Are they expensive at the moment?
They're expensive in a certain sense, but, you know, there's a real big deception, and this we need to discuss because I discuss it in Solartopia, although I'm going to update the discussion. You can take a nuclear plant and say that it generates 1,000 megawatts of electricity, and then you can say that 1,000 megawatts of solar capacity is more expensive. But the reality is that if the solar panels are on your rooftop, then you are going to have a far higher percentage of delivered energy than you get from the nuclear plant.
Mm.
The nuclear plants are incredibly inefficient.
Tell us how they are inefficient, nuclear power plants.
Well, they're an enormously powerful engine of mass destruction, as you and I know, but they generate huge quantities of heat, which should be usable energy. But in fact, it's waste energy, heating the rivers to the point that many reactors have had to shut down in France and in Alabama and elsewhere because the rivers are too hot to handle the waste heat.
What percentage of the energy goes out and is lost as heat?
You know, it varies tremendously, but it's well over 30 to 40%, you know, and these numbers, you know, of course, vary from reactor to reactor, and also from season to season. But the reality is that cooling towers and outtake pipes are the surest sign of a massively wasteful technology.
Yeah.
And so a very small percentage of the electricity, of the energy that's produced in a fission reactor is actually converted to electricity. And then when it goes out on the wires, even more is lost. As you all know, at least 25%, sometimes even more, of the electricity that comes off what they call the bus bar and then goes into the grid disappears from the grid. And then you get to the home or to the business, and there's still more lost in the conversion process. And the incandescent light bulb, of course, is extremely inefficient. You know, the incandescent light bulb is really, really good for generating heat as opposed to light.
Yeah.
They're better heaters than they are on lighting. Now, we're getting a little bit of that efficiency back with fluorescence, and we may get some more back with the new technologies, LED lighting and so on. But the fact is that from the commercial reactor, from the core of the reactor to the actual light bulb, we lose as much as 90% of the energy.
Isn't that amazing?
It is crazy. It's sheer lunacy. What we can't, and not only that, but what we lose is a major contributor to global warming.
Yeah.
I mean, here you have these people running around saying, well, nuclear plants don't emit CO2, which, of course, you and I know is false if you talk about the nuclear fuel cycle. But the fact is that they eliminate the middleman by introducing heat directly into the atmosphere and into the water. And all that is pure waste, whereas a photovoltaic cell on a rooftop may be allegedly less efficient than a nuclear plant, but in fact, If the energy is taken right there and not transmitted over many miles, and doesn't have to be converted from heat into electricity, but rather is electricity right from the start, then you have a much higher percentage of usable electricity. And this is a calculation that I'd like to work with Arjun Makajani and some other scientists to perfect, because we don't hear this discussion of usable energy. We hear a discussion of produced energy without accounting for the massive waste. And this is true of coal-fired plants as well, by the way, that, you know, the massive waste that comes with a large central generator. And this we want to really avoid.
This show is If You Love This Planet, and I'm interviewing Harvey Wasserman, a longtime author, journalist, and renewable energy advocate.
One of the major things, and of course in Australia you do have some mass transit, but in the United States our mass transit system has been utterly destroyed. And we had the world's greatest mass transit system as of 1920. As of 1920, only one American family in 10 owned an automobile.
Uh-huh.
People got around on our superb trolley system, which we now call light rail, but people could go anywhere in our cities on light rail systems. There were hundreds of miles of track in big cities like Los Angeles and New York and Washington, and except for some of the East Coast cities, Boston, Washington, in New York primarily, General Motors and Standard Oil and the glass and rubber companies got together beginning in 1920 and essentially consciously destroyed the American mass transit system, both the rail lines inside the city and the intercity rail system. And so at this country, this huge, rich, allegedly developed country, you cannot go on the rails between cities in many, many locales. I live in Columbus, Ohio, which is a city of well over a million people. We were a rail hub in the 1800s, and the last passenger rail train left Columbus, Ohio in 1979. And here we are, people being driven into bankruptcy by $4 a gallon gasoline, and we can't go anywhere because we don't have a mass transit system, which was consciously destroyed. So in Silvertopia, we really have to have a rebuilt mass transit system. People have to be able to go by rail from city to city and inside their cities, or else, you know, we're just not going to make it.
Well, Harvey, some people are using the analogy of the Second World War. When Roosevelt declared war on Japan and Germany, America was building lots of cars and all sorts of things. For 3 years, the automobile industry ceased, and within 3 years, they had built enormous numbers of tanks, airplanes, you name it, and built a massive war machine by everyone getting involved in that. And this is more urgent than... It's interesting to me that you can actually mobilize a country to fight a war more easily and more readily than you can to fight against their own extinction.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it?
And yet it's sort of the same. A war could produce extinction, but more now, this global warming thing and all the rest could produce extinction. And yet people, it's interesting to me too, Harvey, when I look at the magazines and the newspapers, there are huge ads for cars and automobiles and four-wheel drives and what you call them, SUVs and Hummers. And they proceed and they give you all the wonderful statistics about this particular vehicle, like how, you know, 3 seconds from 0 to 100 miles an hour and leather seats. Not one of those ads talks about how fuel efficient they are. Now, I know people are starting to buy Priuses, the hybrids, but the auto industry is so far behind where we need to be.
It's astounding.
Astounding.
Well, you have to remember that we've had a moral and intellectual vacuum in the White House for at least 8 years.
You've got Cheney, who's not moral. He's not a moral vacuum. Yes, he's a moral. No, he's.
He's a reverse vacuum.
He's a reverse vacuum. I mean, he is the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain that makes all the major decisions for this White House without a skerrick of doubt. All his papers are locked up in a safe. No one can get to them. A safe in his office. They destroy material too. But he probably is one of the most dangerous men in history, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. And the damage that they've done to this country and the world is incalculable. I mean, we've lost tremendous time and money and resources that should have been used to pushing the Solartopian revolution and getting us off fossil and nuclear fuels, and yet they've prolonged this horrific failed experiment with the so-called peaceful atom and continue. You know, they've blown up more than 400 hilltops in West Virginia, turning that area into a desert to mine coal. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And we've known these renewable technologies have been proven and cost effective at least since the 1970s, and yet they refuse to go there. And even today in this country, you know, the hybrids are not in evidence. And the real solution, which is the plug-in hybrid, is nowhere to be seen. I mean, you can take a plug-in hybrid and plug it into a solar panel. I have seen in catalogs for years small solar panels which you use to recharge your battery in your car. And I think what the industry is afraid of is people are just going to do this and get off gasoline altogether.
Well,
and it's staggering. We're on the brink of this fantastic technological and economic revolution. And we're being stymied.
Well, in Arjun Makajani's book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, which you can get from his website at ieer.org, he says that we need to put solar panels on every car, a parking lot in the United States, and that's a huge area. You take your car, you plug it in when you go to work, power up the battery, which is a new lithium ion battery that can be recharged 100,000 times, drive your car home at night, and then you can plug it into your house and power up your house, turn on your lights and your radio and the like. And this absolutely. Technology is absolutely here right now, you know, and we need to put the effort that America put into the war under Roosevelt into...
Right. Well, the irony is that the people who are going to do this are the Germans and the Japanese.
Yeah, yeah, isn't that an irony?
it's amazing, you know, the axis of solar energy there. I mean, Germany and Japan are leading the world in these technologies, and there's nothing exotic or unknown about them. I mean, I'm sure there's room for improvement, and we'll have better solar panels and all that stuff, but the basic realities of the technology have been with us for a while.
Well, and cheaper by the dozen. Mass production produces much cheaper, will produce much cheaper panels. You know, it's talking about Dick Cheney, Harvey, and I'm speaking to Harvey Wasserman, an author, a renewable energy advocate, and an anti-nuke activist. I'd like to know the psychopathology of Cheney. That's what fascinates me as a physician. Why is he like he is? What evil forces motivate that man when he had an energy committee composed mostly of coal and nuclear energy people and Enron and who was that guy? Lay. What was his name?
Kenneth Lay.
Kenny Lay. Enron. Kenny Lay. He met with him many times.
Yeah, conveniently dead now, by the way.
I know he's dead, but they composed the energy policy of the United States. Those documents should be available to the public if they have not been made available. And it was Cheney who set this whole thing up. I mean, and we know that Bush isn't really worth talking about in terms of understanding anything, but Cheney does. And he's the one who set up this whole ghastly situation where the Earth is precipitously moving towards, you know, annihilation of, you know, one third or half of the world's species.
It is astounding, and you know, you have to wonder about our species, our species going extinct, and where a guy like Dick Cheney can come from, and how he can gain power like this. And you know, we're in a serious problem. I think primarily because of court decisions in this country that have equated money with free speech. After the Watergate scandal, we had a good chance to really limit the power of money in our political system, and it didn't happen. And that's I think we're still paying a very serious price for that, and we're going to have to somehow get corporate money out of our government before we're really going to move ahead, because these oil companies have too much money to lose by getting us, you know, allowing us to get to the solutions, the coal companies as well. I mean, wind power will do to the coal companies, you know, what hybrids and the electric cars will do to the oil companies, and these people have too big investments. They're making too much money.
Well,
have to stop this.
Yeah. I can only describe this as evil. You know, it's funny, when I fly into the United States from Australia, we're a bit involved in money here too, and, you know, we've sort of joined the globalization ethic and all of that. But as soon as you hit America, people are screaming at you about money. Every radio station, what you can save, what you can buy now, it's all about money. And money is the God. And churches will say, you know, we're about God and we're about Jesus or about, you know, whatever the religion promotes. But the bottom line in the United States is money. And I think it's true. I mean, I'm not a Christian. I'm kind of a pantheist. But Jesus did say a really good thing. He said many good things. But he said it's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. And until we can replace the ethic of money and selfishness and greed with an ethic of helping one another and saving the fabulous life process on this, you know, tiny little planet in the universe, I think we're doomed. I do also think, and I'm doing a bit of a riff now, Harvey, that every person has a great deal of beauty and morality within their soul if they tap into it, and that we all know right from wrong. And now that we're understanding more and more what money and greed and corporate power is and has done to the planet and the misuse of science, if we rise up and develop a massive grassroots movement that's well educated, we can obviously turn this around. And I guess that's our challenge, right, Harvey?
Well, I don't think we have any choice. I mean, and one of the presumptions of Solartopia is that we will get there because I happen to believe in the survival instinct of the human animal, and I think that you're right about morality. I think deep down inside we all know what's right and what's necessary. And so what's necessary now in the 21st century is to get off fossil and nuclear fuels and do what the technology shows us we can do. Now, we have the benefit of something we didn't have 30 years ago when you and I were first at Seabrook, which is that we do have a mature a renewable energy industry.
Mm.
It's not totally where it can be and needs to be, but this is an industry that is not dependent on federal subsidies and that is not pie in the sky, and it is very profitable.
Mm.
And, you know, these companies that are doing the windmills and solar companies, they are making money, and they will make even more money. Whereas in the 70s, we were kind of saying, well, if we don't spend the money on nukes and we spend it instead on renewables, maybe we'll get renewables. Well, whatever happened in the last 30 years, we have a hugely profitable wind power business, and we have a solar industry that is going to be even more profitable, because every building in the country, really every building in the world at some point, will have photovoltaic cells on them in one form or another. We also have biofuels, which have been beaten up, but, you know, that's because they're using the wrong crops.
Mm.
We have geothermal. We have many other forms of energy which are proven and clean and reliable and produce jobs.
Mm.
And so the presumption of Solartopia is that because we are committed to our own survival, we will find a way to get there, and we cannot survive without getting to a Solartopian solution for for our energy supply. And this means, of course, first and foremost, getting rid of nuclear power plants.
Yep. I'm speaking to the lovely Harvey Wasserman. I'm Helen Caldicott on If You Love This Planet. Now, Harvey, you wrote a book, How the GOP Stole America's 2004 Election and Is Rigging 2008, published by the New Press, which is my publisher too. Tell us about that, Harvey, in a potted version.
Well, we all have accidents in our life that turn out to not be accidents. So I happened to grow up in Columbus, Ohio, never knew what I was doing here. And then in 2004, I have a really good co-writer at freepress.org, which is our website, www.freepress.org. And we just watched unfold before our very eyes the theft of a presidential election. And there, I will tell you up front, there is no doubt in my mind that John Kerry was the rightful winner of the 2004 election, and that George Bush has absolutely no business being in the White House,
from
2000 and not from 2004 either. And so what they did in Ohio here, they had a Secretary of State who was responsible for running the election, who was also the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign, a slight conflict of interest.
Slight.
And he did, you know, 100 different things to rig the vote count and the turnout and any other thing they could get out their hands on in the 2004 election to prevent John Kerry from getting the Electoral College votes that, in fact, decided the presidency in 2004. And in the neighborhood where I grew up, which is now mostly black, it took 5 hours to vote. And in the neighborhood where I now live, which is mostly white, but is only a mile away from where I grew up, it took 5 minutes to vote.
And these
are the kinds of things that went on before, during, and after the election of 2004. And so how the GOP stole America's 2004 election is a bullet point, an executive summary of how the election was stolen. And then we wrote another book, which we did with the Free Press, your excellent publisher, called What Happened in Ohio, and that is a document book, a book of documents of what happened in the theft here of this election. But it was like a tutorial in how to steal an election. I'm convinced, actually, they did a lot of things here in Ohio that they didn't need to do, but they just wanted to see if they could get away with them. And they did. You know, that's the tragedy of the situation.
Well, tell us about some of the things they did.
Well, I'll go from beginning to middle to end. In the beginning, they rigged the registration rolls. They prevented people from registering. They played around with the absentee ballots. And I'm a plaintiff in a lawsuit because they did this to me. I went downtown to register to get an absentee ballot, and then I got a notice saying that they had the wrong address. But I've been living at the same house for 20 years, and the notice came to the right address. mean, it's ridiculous. And I had to call four times, and literally hundreds of people had similar stories, failing to get absentee ballots. People showed up at the polls who had voted at the same address all their lives, and suddenly were not on the poll books anymore. Were not allowed to vote. So this, and of course, most of them were black, who voted 90% for Kerry in 2004. So this went on all over the state. We know that for sure. We, on Election Day, many of the precincts in the inner cities, which were going 90% for Kerry, people showed up, and there were no voting machines. The county and the state which ran the election knew that this was going to be a record turnout, and that they shortchanged people in the inner city, and people showed up and couldn't vote for the mere fact that there was nothing to vote on. And meanwhile, in the white Republican suburbs, they had more voting machines than they knew what to do with. And that many other things like that happened. And then after the election, ballots disappeared. Many, many ballots were simply not counted. We had one situation in Warren County, which is a heavily Republican county, where the moment the polls closed, the election board announced a Homeland Security alert, which has never been traced. The FBI, the Homeland Security Agency, nobody called this Homeland Security alert except the election board. And they grabbed all the ballots and all the records and took them to a remote location and barred the media and barred the press, rather the public, from seeing the vote count. And from this one county, George Bush emerged with a huge plurality, much larger than what he had in 2000. And between that and two other counties, he emerged with a sufficient margin to win the election in Ohio.
It sounds like Zimbabwe and Mugabe.
Yes, or the Philippines under Marcos, or Nicaragua under Somoza. I mean, you know, what happened was that George Bush the first, who ran the CIA and who stole election after election after election, that apparatus simply applied those tactics, those third world tactics, to Ohio in 2004. It's a classic instance of blowback, where what you do, you know, and karma, what you do around the world and what you do to other people eventually is going to come back on you. And so the tactics that were used to steal elections in countries that were going to elect leaders that we didn't like suddenly were used in Ohio. There are four states in 2004 that swung the election, where the exit polls showed clearly that John Kerry won by substantial margins. And those exit polls came in at 12:20 at night. And then at 9 in the morning, miraculously, with a third world technique, Iowa, New Mexico, Nevada, and Ohio switched from the blue column for Kerry to the red column for Bush, and that's how Bush won the election.
My God.
We call them the purple states, but there is no way. We've done the statistical analysis. There is no way that George Bush won those states.
My God. Harvey, now I want you to talk about the upcoming election this year when we have Barack Obama running. What power do the Republicans currently have in the state of Ohio in terms of influencing this upcoming election?
Well, in terms of the vote count, thankfully their power is somewhat diminished. We now have a Democratic governor who actually seems reasonably sane, and we have a Secretary of State who's not the co-chair of the McCain campaign. That'll be a help. And she has committed herself to a cleaner ballot, but although they have not done everything we'd like, we still have in this country a substantial number of electronic voting machines which can be rigged. Mm. We've shown now a dozen different ways that these electronic machines can be manipulated and the vote count swung from one side to the other, even by a Wi-Fi machine. I mean, you can drive by and change the outcome of election. And these machines should have been gotten rid of a long time ago. We are very much in favor of just a paper ballot. We want to have a national holiday and let the high school and college students count these ballots. But every ballot should be cast on paper as far as we're concerned. And unfortunately, in the 2008 election, that will not be the case. And so there is still margin, especially in places like Florida, where the Republicans could, in fact, steal an election. I think that Barack Obama will be, first of all, I believe he has to nominate a woman, whether it's Hillary Clinton or otherwise, and I think it's long overdue, frankly.
To be vice president.
Yes. you know, a combination of a black candidate, well, him in particular, I think he's a very good campaigner, and a woman, I think they can beat McCain if we can get a fair vote count. I do think race will be an issue. We do have a phenomenon in this country called the Bradley effect, where polls tend to show a black candidate running fairly well, and suddenly they lose. And it may in part be due to a stolen vote count, but people in this country tend to say they will vote for a candidate of color and then often won't, just the way it is. But he will have his work cut out for him, but things are so bad in America now. The war is such a horror, such a travesty. Everybody knows it was based on lies, and it's a futile attempt, if there's even a reason that can be, you know, attributed to it. Our economy is in terrible shape. We don't have health care. The environment is being destroyed. We don't have mass transit. This has been a horrific, every bad dream that you could ever imagine when George Bush was coming into office has been realized, and worse. And so, you know, it is a time when the opposition party should take power. And I think it's possible. I just hope that when it does happen, that it's followed by real action, because this country really is on its way down very, very rapidly. The morale in the United States is very, very low, and for good reason. We've been hijacked, and our democracy has been run into the ground, and we really have a thin reed by which we can retake it. Part of it is talk shows like yours and the Internet, where we've been barely able to keep alive a semblance of an information flow. I mean, you and I both know that a major symptom and cause of the problem here is the corporate domination of the media and the unwillingness of the media to cover the real story about nuclear power and renewables and what's really happening with the environment and the economy. And it's really only shows like yours and the Internet and a few other outlets that have given us any kind of information. But I think the country is ready for a turnaround. It's just going to be a massive job for the next person who comes in.
That's true, Harvey. Harvey Wasserman, an author, an anti-nuclear person, and someone who writes extremely well on renewable energy. Just to add to that conversation, Harvey, and I'm Helen Caldicott. This show is called If You Love This Planet, incidentally. The way America goes will determine the fate of the Earth. I mean, it's not just a mess domestically in the United States, but the United States is the prototype for China, for India, for the developing nations, indeed for my own country, Australia. Everyone wants to emulate what America does, and it's partly because of the power of your advertising industry. We get all your ads, you know. All the advertising agencies in Australia are American-owned. They just changed the accent to Australians. But advertising is so powerful, using the media of television and radio, and people, even though they mightn't agree with an ad, tend to go out and buy the stuff they've just heard about. And I think we need to investigate that too, but everyone sort of wants what is advertised, and I'm not quite sure how to turn that around, because it's partly consumerism, of course. I mean, you think of China, almost everything you buy now is made in China. And it's using a huge amount of energy to make all these sort of stuffed bears and articles you buy in sort of souvenir shops, to refrigerators, to stoves, to washing, I mean, to the whole thing. And the Chinese, of course, have glommed onto this because it's a fantastic way to make money and improve their economy and the like. But they've bought into this consumer ethic that will lead to the downfall of, I think, of life on Earth if it goes unchecked. And so if America changes in a very substantial way and starts to look at itself and develop humility and an understanding of where it really needs to go, it can really lead the Earth towards sanity and survival. Would you agree with that, Harvey?
Absolutely. And you know, I teach history. I am a historian. And we have a phenomenal tradition in this country. You know, there are many problems with the American Revolution in that it left out women, it left out blacks, although many slaves did get their freedom during the American Revolution, and left out certainly the American Indians. But, you know, the Bill of Rights that was drafted and ratified in 1791 remains one of the great documents ever written, and really one of the true beacons for civil liberties and rights in world civilization. And I believe there's a great tradition in this country of being close to nature, which comes from the Native Americans, as well as, of course, the Aboriginals and the Maoris and other Native fourth world, as we call them, or first world, I guess we call them, peoples. But the fact is that all the elements are here, and we have people who are continued to be active.
Mm.
And you know, this idea that people have not marched against the Iraq War is utterly false.
Mm.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, there have been more people active against the Iraq War than were active against the Vietnam War, and that's without a draft.
Mm.
The problem is that the media has refused to cover.
Yeah.
And we really have the media is a big part of the problem here, as you well know. And it's something that has to be solved. But the reality is that we have all the basics of a revival here and the abilities to turn it around. And we just have to keep campaigning until we do this. It is a moral question. It's a spiritual question. But it's also a question of survival and of economics. And I think as we see our way clear, I think that a lot of these things, these battles, we're going to win. I will tell you one thing. I mean, as an activist in this country, I've been somewhat spoiled. I got involved in the civil rights movement. We made huge strides.
Uh-huh.
To the point we now have a black man running for president, which was unthinkable even 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Though we've lost many, you know, civil rights battles, we've won many. We were very successful in many ways in the anti-Vietnam campaign, and I've seen in just locally and nationally many environmental battles won, and I believe that we can win this one, primarily against nuclear power and then peeling away the other problems. And the good news now is that the economy really works on our side now. People are coming to understand that we cannot afford a fossil nuclear economy, and we cannot afford an automobile-based transport system.
Mm.
And so it's going to be a wrenching and difficult transition, but the handwriting, I think, is clearly on the wall.
Well, and you left out one massive movement which was successful, and that was the anti-nuclear weapons movement, the nuclear freeze movement in the 80s, where 80% of Americans joined that and said they didn't want nuclear weapons anymore bilaterally between Russia and America. And that did actually lead to the end of the Cold War. And that was I would say that was the second American Revolution. It was peaceful, sagacious, calm and quiet, but by God, were we successful?
I think the fact that we're still here, you know, we did have 8 years of a seriously unbalanced guy in the White House in the 1980s, who I think was capable of dropping the bomb, and he didn't. You had a conversation with him.
Yep.
And you know, Ronald Reagan, and who knows if it not for the anti-nuclear weapons movement, if they wouldn't have used nuclear weapons in the 80s.
Mm.
Dwight Eisenhower actually was asked in 1952 to use nuclear weapons by the French in Vietnam, and thankfully he didn't. And one crowning moment, and I will say this as someone who marched against the war in Vietnam, in Richard Nixon's autobiography, he states that he would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam had it not been for the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, if anyone ever needs a ratification or confirmation of the fruitfulness of being active, that was certainly it.
Harvey, how long is the Bill of Rights? I have a terrible confession to make that I've never read it. How long is it? How many pages?
It's only a few hundred words. And the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which I'll recite for you, is about 75. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, in that one paragraph, we have separation of church and state, we have freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, right to peaceably assemble, and right to be active against the government. And James Madison, who compiled the Bill of Rights, probably has made the greatest literary contribution to political freedom in all of human history. And I must say that the Americans, for all their frivolousness and materialism, we do still revere that Bill of Rights.
Mm.
And we fight tooth and nail over the smallest paragraphs and even in words, you know, probable cause, for example. These phrases are still with us, consent of the government. And so it's been a document that's held up and what we needed, and unfortunately didn't get. In 1954, Franklin Roosevelt drafted or helped to draft an economic Bill of Rights, and this guaranteed all Americans a job, education, transportation, medical care, the right to farm if you owned a farm, and this was ratified as a resolution of Congress, but did not become part of our Constitution. And that's unfortunate.
I've got two suggestions. We've got a web page called ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Your interview will be put up there, and I want us to put the Bill of Rights next to your interview, and two,
that'd be great.
Two, that FDR resolution about freedom for everyone to have a job and free transportation, free medical care. I want that to go up too so that everyone can refer to those two incredibly important documents.
Absolutely. And then you can do the third one, of course, which is Franklin Roosevelt's wife, who I think was actually more important than he was, Eleanor, who helped draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which became part of the United Nations mandate.
How long is that?
Oh, it's not very long. It's longer, but I'll send it to you and you can decide.
All right, we'll decide.
But, you know, what we now need, of course, is a Solartopian Bill of Rights where we get beyond fossil fuels and where all people are guaranteed the right to clean air and clean water and a non-global warmed planet and access to mass transit. These are things that are part of the 21st century Bill of Rights.
Okay, now, so you will draft that Solartopian Bill of Rights, which will be short and precise and concise.
Yes, I actually have. It's got 8 points.
Okay, well, you'll send that, and we'll put that up next to your interview too, Harvey.
Oh, fantastic. And thank you so much, Helen.
And I want to thank you, Harvey. We're soulmates in a way. You and I have worked together side by side.
I love the sound of your voice. you're perfect for radio, and it's just great to hear your voice. And, you know, having heard you speak and been with you in so many important activist occasions, it's just an honor to be with you on the radio.
Well, I feel the same way, Harvey, and thank you so much for coming on. And hopefully we'll live for another 20 years and we'll keep active and doing what we have to do, right?
You bet. Absolutely. Call me anytime.
How old are you now?
62.
Yeah, well, I'm 70 this year, which is a pain in the neck. But anyway, another 20.
Well, hey, what's the alternative?
Oh, death. Another 20 years and we can make a big impact, Harvey.
I think you're in great shape and just keep active. And, all our listeners here, just remember that this is a winnable victory and that Solartopia is at hand.
Okay. Thank you, my love. Harvey Wasserman.
Thank you, dear.
I've been talking with Harvey Wasserman, who's an author, a journalist, and renewable energy advocate. And I think it was a very efficacious session this time on If You Love This Planet. You can find more information about Harvey and his work at harveywasserman.com, harveywasserman.com. I think that was a very profound conversation with Harvey Wasserman. We really got down to the bottom line. The bottom line is, does America really have an active and doable democracy? Do the Americans really have the heart and soul, fortitude and courage to take on their country and their democracy and themselves and their societies and their families to lead the world towards sanity and survival in this very precarious time that we currently live in? I really believe that Americans do. I think that Americans are some of the kindest people that I've ever met in the world who desperately want to do the right thing. And now's your time. Now's your time. If you are at all spiritual in any way and you really worship life on the planet and you love it when the roses come out in the spring and the dogwoods flower and the wisteria blossoms and the butterflies fly around and the birds sing, if you love that deeply in your soul, if you love this planet, you're going to do the right thing. We're waiting for you, America. Don't forget, if you'd like to make a donation to the program, please visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. That was a track called Mimosa Rock by Australian duo The Receptionists. Thank you for joining us on If You Love This Planet. A very special thanks to our host Pacifica station, KPFT, Houston, Texas. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and next week I'll be interviewing a radioactive waste specialist from Beyond Nuclear, Kevin Camps.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.